We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with David Gill. He is a Democratic candidate for Congress in Illinois' 15th Congressional District. He is a physician. He works as an emergency room doctor, makes his home in Bloomington. And this is his third run for Congress in the 15th District. He ran in 2004 and 2006. Will be running again this year against the incumbent Republican Tim Johnson. He's a graduate, that is Dr. Gill's, a graduate of the U of I. He got a bachelor's degree in math here and also went to med school here. And we're glad that he could be here in the studio. Now, the idea here is that we hope that people who are living in the 15th District will take the opportunity to ask questions. So, you know, whatever it is that's most important to you, you want to know how he stands on that issue, you can call in. Now, I can ask some basic questions and will, but the important reason for doing the show is for potential voters to be able to talk with him. So that's what we're doing. I have somebody who is already ready to go here in Urbana. We'll get to in just a moment. I do want to give the phone number here in Urbana and Champaign, the local number 333-9455. If it would be a long-distance call, there may be some people in the 15th, it would be a long-distance call. That's 800-222-9455, so that's toll-free. And also we tell people, you know, if you'd like to send an email, we can do that now. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Before we get going here, I do also want to mention that we extended the same opportunity to Tim Johnson, said if you'd like to come here in the studio, talk with us, take calls, you're certainly welcome, and he declined. So with that, we have three folks here lined up and ready to go. We say, hey, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me just ask a kind of a general question, and then we'll get some calls. I think that we know that surveys tell us that there are a lot of people who feel the country is going in the wrong direction. They're very concerned with the economy, and they're very concerned with the role of government. And we also know that we're told that there's a pretty strong anti-incumbent sentiment out there. But it seems as if that the Democrats and Democratic Party, and perhaps it's because they control the Congress and the president's a Democrat, get more criticism than Republicans do. Do you think, are there some ways in which you feel that the Democratic Party has made some mistakes or gone in certain directions that it shouldn't?
Oh, certainly. And when I'm out on the campaign trail traveling these 22 counties, I try to make it plain to people that, yes, I'm a Democrat, but I receive no funding from any national political party. My funding comes from the ordinary citizens that live here, and that's who I intend to represent. And so, I'm quick to criticize both parties for what I view as mistakes. The Democrats, for instance, I think the health care reform bill was a tremendous lost opportunity. Wound up leaving the existing power structures in place, and really it brought about a couple of minor improvements, but it didn't bring about the type of changes that we need. The surge in Afghanistan, I disagree with. You could go up and down the list, and I think that the people of Illinois 15 can do better. The anti-incumbency thing is very, very real. You know, I've been in 200 parades and town festivals, and they don't ask anymore what party I'm in. Every other hand that I shake simply asks if I'm in office or out of office. And when I tell them that I don't occupy an elected office, they immediately become a supporter. And so I think that there's a lot of pain out there.
Mm-hmm. Has the Democratic National Committee, did they offer you any money?
No, they never have through any of the three campaigns. And frankly, if they were to come to me today, you know, it's a selling point, frankly. Mm-hmm. The district is gerrymandered. It's drawn to be 70% Republican. And I think it's reassuring to people when I go traveling throughout this district and let them know that that my obligation is strictly to them and not to party bosses nor to corporate masters, for that matter, that they appreciate that. Yeah, I think that's just the type of politics and politician that people are looking for in this day and age.
Yeah. As I have seen it, the figures I've seen are several months old now, but there was a pretty big imbalance between the amount of money that you have for your campaign and the amount of money that Representative Johnson has. Does that matter to you?
Sure. I mean, it would be nice to have more money, but I think more importantly is to do it the right way. And to me, the right way is not to take a bunch of funding from some other source, such as a party or a corporation. And I think people respect that. And I think, I've shaken literally 250,000 hands over the past 12 to 16 months. And as people have gotten to know me directly, I think that it's paying dividends. And we've got, 1,000 volunteers throughout the 22 counties. It's a true grassroots phenomenon. So, yeah, money would make it easier. You know, to be frank, we're not advertising on TV this time. Funds are limited, but also, I think the TV commercials turn people off, and I don't think they attend to them to any extent at all.
We have three callers here, and they are all ready to go, and so we'll just start right in. Well, first person in line is in Urbana, and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was glad to hear David Gill mention health care. My question to him is, if you were to go to Washington in the House of Representatives, what kinds of changes would you work for in the present health care bill?
Okay. Well, it's a good question. You know, when I started this campaign, my focus in my first campaign back in 2004 was health care. I work in health care and have been in it for more than a quarter century, and so it's something near and dear to me, and it's what drove me initially to run. We tried to expand things with the second campaign. There's a lot of issues that I'm interested in and tried to make that clear to people. When I started this campaign, people said, well, you can't talk about healthcare anymore because it's going to be done by the time the election of 2010 comes. And sadly, it's not anywhere near done. As I indicated, they really didn't accomplish much with the reform that they did pass. There's been a lot of hyperbole on both sides of the aisle with regards to what passed. And I think that's a lot of political hot air. Those who say it's a grand historic achievement, I disagree with that. Those who say it's Armageddon, I disagree with that. They really did nothing with regards to cost controls. And they left the private health insurance industry running the thing. The private health insurance industry wrote the bill, which really goes to the broad theme of my campaign, which is that we simply must stop this corporate takeover of our politics and our government. They put $4 million into Max Baucus's campaigns, and his top two aides who helped write the bill came directly across the street from WellPoint. And until this country gets away from this model where we depend on private health insurance to be responsible for our health care, we're going to be dealing with this problem on and on and on. The overhead with private health insurance is 30% to 40%. It leaves so many people uncared for. We still have somebody dying every 12 minutes in this country just for lack of health insurance. I had one of my own patient about 3 months ago. And so I'll be working for what I've always talked about, and that's an improved Medicare for all type approach, that if you're an American citizen, you get an Uncle Sam health care card, and you're enrolled in Medicare automatically. The overhead with Medicare is 3% to 4%, and I recognize the flaws inherent within Medicare, but they're all fixable. You know, if I was to give Medicare a school grade, I would give it a B or perhaps a B-. It's far better than what we see in terms of health care and cost efficiency with the private health insurance industry.
All right. And, there are Republicans who have said that they would attempt to repeal what was passed if they in fact secure majorities in the Congress. Do you think that that's actually likely, that there would then be a big project mounted to actually go back and repeal what was passed?
I'd be surprised because there are a couple of good things in there. You know, the extension of benefits to your children until they're age 26, doing away with the turning people away because of pre-existing conditions, those types of things, they're good things. Granted, it still leaves room for the private health insurance industry to bump up premiums as needed to account for those good changes. But I think that's a lot of electioneering and politicking when they talk about repeal.
All right. Champagne is next. Line two. Hello.
Yes, Dr. Gill, I voted for you twice before. And
thank
I was
you.
Interested, you said very quickly you had opposed the surge by President Obama in Afghanistan. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that for your listeners. And also, what about the drone strikes into Pakistan? Thank you.
Sure. I don't think that our presence in Afghanistan or along the Afghan-Pakistani border is making us at all more secure. And I think that it's time that we eliminate our presence there, you know, begin a prompt withdrawal of our forces from that part of the world. I think this idea that that we can make ourselves more secure by having active duty troops or drone strikes like you talk about in these two limited places within the world is it doesn't hold water. There's terrorist cells all over this globe. You know, people that would like to strike at America and American interests, and to think that we are improving that situation by having active duty, you know, large numbers of active duty troops in these two places, it doesn't make sense to me. And so I think that we should be removing ourselves from these places rather than adding more troops, as the president has done.
Another caller here, Bloomington Normal, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, what I wondered is why, if you have any idea why Tim Johnson seems to be afraid to talk to people face-to-face. I know he talks all the time on cell phones, but some of us in Bloomington Normal tried to get him over here, and we gave him a two-month period of time to come, and he still refused to come, just to talk to some folks. I don't understand it, and I don't know whether you do.
No, I don't understand it. And, you know, he will not attend any candidate forum that I'm at. He refuses to debate me. He said that the voters wouldn't find it particularly illuminating were his campaign's words. And I don't know if that's simply politicking on his part, if he doesn't like to be present when his record is called. You know, when I call, there's a number of votes that he has cast that aren't widely publicized that I call him out on. And I'm not sure why he won't participate. But as I've said at numerous candidate forums where he's not present, I think he's insulting the voters and the people that show up at these forums in that it's a part of the democratic process. You know, he's got every right to show up or not show up wherever he wants to. But, you know, I have every right to speak about his record then. And it's disappointing to me. And the pledge I make to people is that when I finally get around to winning this seat, that should I decide to run for re-election, I will show up in person at these various forums and debates and other public settings.
Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. We have certainly time for others, and the phone lines are open if you'd like to talk with our guest, David Gill. He's a Democratic candidate for Congress in Illinois' 15th congressional district. He is going up against Republican incumbent Tim Johnson. This will be his third time. He ran for the U.S. House in both 2004 and 2006. He's a physician. That's where he makes his living. He's an emergency room doctor. So, as he has said, one of the issues that has always been very important to him is health care. So if you want to ask about that or anything else, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to just go back to the health care for a bit, just
sure,
to make sure I understand. So what's your the way that you would get at the making sure that everybody has health care essentially would be to enroll everybody in Medicare.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you know, I talk about healthcare quite a bit. I kind of narrow it down to two little stories, if you want, healthcare in America in a nutshell. One story is the story of William McGuire. He's a man who retired as the CEO of United Healthcare back in 2006. And as a parting gift, United Healthcare is one of the five giant health insurance companies in this country. As a parting gift, the company gave him $1.6 billion with a B dollars. And it's difficult for people to translate what $1.6 billion is. But when you do the arithmetic, they gave William McGuire $100,000 a day, every day, to spend on himself for not a year, not a decade, for 40 years. For 40 to 45 years, Mr. McGuire gets to spend $100,000 a day on himself. And that's money that people sent in as premiums to care for themselves and for their loved ones. That's one part of American healthcare. The other part is, as I alluded to, I saw a woman 3 months ago named Susan, came in cardiac arrest, 47 years old. We tried to resuscitate her and failed, and she died. And I went to speak with her husband, and he broke down. And after he got a hold of himself, he told me that a week earlier she had been in another emergency department with chest pain. They'd given her nitroglycerin under her tongue. The pain had resolved, and it had been suggested that she be admitted and worked up and properly treated. And she and he worked full-time, worked hard, but unfortunately they had those jobs that are so common in America today, jobs without health insurance. And so they looked at each other and said, well, we better not. We better go on home. And so a week later, there she was, you know, stone cold dead. And had she had the fortune to live in Canada or Britain or France or Germany or Japan or any other developed country in the world other than America, she'd likely be alive today. And that happens every 12 minutes. So you've got a Susan dying every 12 minutes. You've got numerous Mr. Maguires walking around spending $100,000 a day on themselves every day for 40 years. And my opponent says that's the best healthcare system in the world. And he just couldn't be further from the truth. And it's that type of attitude of his that inspires me to continue pressing forward and try to take this seat away, because I think we need a representative in Washington who fully understands the problem, who understands how to fix it, and who understands that when we do fix it, it'll be a great leap forward for our economy. To spend $600, $800 billion a year on the William Maguires of the world, to pour that money into a black hole is utter waste, and to take it and put it back into our economy and into healthcare, it would do wonders. There's studies that show 2.5 to 3 million new jobs created on day one when you do healthcare the way I'm talking about.
Well, now you did also say that you see flaws in Medicare. Well,
sure.
So what are the major flaws?
Oh, some of the substantial co-pays. The Medicare prescription bill was, you know, I consider it an utter joke and a $2 trillion gift to the prescription drug industry, underwritten through our Medicare system, where Mr. Johnson and others said, yes, in spite of the fact that I have 50 million Medicare lives worth of bargaining power, I will forego all that bargaining power and say, yes, Uncle Sam may not negotiate on drug price with the drug companies. Primarily the co-pays and the fact that we still demand a great deal of our seniors unnecessarily with regards to the cost of their health care. And I'm not talking about giving things to people. You know, it ought not to be an utter giveaway. I've talked at length about the need for co-pays for non-emergent things, but they're not co-pays to generate revenue. They're co-pays to foster a sense of appreciation and respect, to a recognition that there is something of value being transacted when healthcare is provided. I've talked about that for a long time. I just discovered about a year ago that France has co-pays like that, and France has long been viewed by public health experts as the number one healthcare system in the world. So, and also I'd like to add that I don't view the health insurance companies as evil. You know, I'm bashing them all day long, every day, and they're not evil. They're performing their mission. Their mission statement is to generate profit, to take care of their shareholders. It's our mistake as a society in turning over our healthcare system to what is a money-making machine.
Yeah. Other calls. We have several here, and first in line is in Champaign, and line one. Hello. Caller there, line one. Yes, go ahead.
I really wish you luck in this campaign. Again, I'm going to be supporting you. One of the things I'd like to mention, though, or a couple of things, is one of the reasons that I think the Republicans have had such great success over the last few elections since Bush was elected was they really seized the opportunity to frame the discussion in terms that they want, and they leave it there. And, you know, Democrats have, by and large, for some reason, allowed them to do that. And I'm wondering, you know, what are you going to be able to do to, you know, seize the opportunity to frame the discussion in different ways that, you know, will point it to? And also, you know, we're looking at change and such, and even when you're looking at, you know, removing an incumbent, we're talking about change. And people respond to change emotionally much more than they do thinking. That's one of the reasons Obama won was because he appealed to people's emotion. And one of the things he gets criticized for as president is that when he talks, he's too professorial. And, you know, he's lost that touch with the emotions. And it's one way that you're going to bring change is that emotions are going to trump thinking every time. And I'm just wondering, you know, how you might be able to build that into your campaign.
I appreciate that. And you're right about messaging. And, you know, I talk when I talk about healthcare, I talk about it being both a moral outrage and an economic nightmare. And depending on the setting and what people are interested in, I try to remind them that I'm talking about giving them back 30 to 40% of the dollars that they're currently spending on healthcare that are going for nothing, that are going to fund the William Maguires of the world. You know, it kind of depends on how they want to look at that. I also try to remind people that we do need to take control back of our government, and I let them know that I don't receive any funding from the National Democratic Party, and there's an appeal with respect to that. People are tired of career politics and career politicians, and, you know, there's a lot of talk about going negative. I call it going fact-based. There's a whole lot about my opponent that people don't recognize. The media is very busy. They've got a number of different avenues that they look at. And for an example, back in late July of this year, there was a funding, an appropriations bill, House Resolution 5822. And talk about emotions. This strikes at people's emotions when they hear about it. It was funding for the health care for our veterans for the year 2011. And it passed by an overwhelming bipartisan majority, 411-6. And Mr. Johnson was one of the six who said no to health care for veterans. And I take that message in. We've got flyers that I take in to every VFW and American Legion in the 22 counties. And people become very emotional about that. And, you know, and call that going negative. I call it going fact-based. It's something that people need to know about their representative. And if the media won't inform them, I'll inform them.
If you were to be elected, how many terms would you serve? Have you thought about that?
I've signed a pledge to co-sponsor a bill to bring a constitutional amendment to limit the terms of U.S. House members and U.S. senators. So I wouldn't unilaterally disarm as my opponent did. That's another thing I have to remind people about. Term limits are it's a very popular concept. I'm a big supporter of it. I think it would go a long way toward restoring and preserving our democracy. My opponent gave you a pledge in 2000 saying he would leave by 2006. It helped him beat Bill Brady in a tight primary back in 2000. He's still there, you know, 4 years later, seeking, you know, 4 years after 2006, seeking two more years. It's a great contrast between he and I. So I wouldn't unilaterally disarm the way he did, but I would actively work to see every representative and senator limited. I think that it should be a service and that then people should go back home and allow people with other areas of expertise to step forth and serve their country.
So, but you're not going in and saying, well, if I were elected, I would serve one term, two terms, three terms.
I'll tell you this, David. I would like to keep taking two or three shifts in the ER each month so as not to get rusty, because I want to keep being a doctor, and I don't intend to do this on a career basis.
Okay.
But I won't. I'm not going to lay down a certain number, you know, whether one term, two terms, four terms. I'd be surprised if I stayed there a decade, but no promises. I don't want to have to make it be a false pledge someday.
Another caller, line two. Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. Well, I think the real term limits is reforming the funding for electoral systems. We have this travesty of the Chamber of Commerce in their brief to the Supreme Court on the thing that unleashed a lot of this money suggested that disclosure was important, but now we see how sincere that was. Disclosure was voted down, and we don't know who's funding all these rank and awful ads, but I wasn't really going to speak about that. But I think that's a fairer electoral system would be a better priority than talking about a term limit constitutional change. I'm gratified that you were so direct in saying about withdrawal from Afghanistan, because you made the great point, which is that it's not helping things; it's making things worse. We're creating more enemies, and we're throwing them all into the same basket by our strategy right now, and we need a grand bargain to solve the situation there, it seems to me. Johnson, I wanted to diss him a little bit in the sense that he gets a pass to vote on things when it doesn't matter. I've seen this so many times, particularly on environmental issues. Now, there's a strong Republican conservation vote in this district, as well as the Democratic ecological vote. And I wanted you to address that issue, but in the context that Johnson gets a pass to vote on things when it's going to pass and or when it's not going to pass from his leadership. I don't think his pledge to vote against funding for the wars is authentic at all. I don't see why anybody takes that seriously. It's another situation where he's given a pass to vote for something that his constituencies are certainly in favor of, but has no particular meaning. And I think we need a broader critique of that. So you might say something about the war and the ecology, I guess, and I appreciate your perseverance in going up there again and at least trying to raise the issues, and it's scandalous that he won't even treat the subjects that he's going to be voting on in the future with you in a public setting. Thank you.
All right. Well, go ahead.
That's a lot of material. I appreciate all that you bring up. I'll take these things in no particular order. Yeah, my opponent voted no on the Disclose Act so that you could know where the funding was coming from for the various advertisements that you're now seeing on TV and listening to on radio. And, you know, that, again, that Citizens United decision, that's something the previous caller had asked about emotions. That's really resonated emotionally amongst the electorate. I think that has something to do with some of the growth of the Tea Party. You know, regardless of how the Tea Party was born, whether it was Dick Armey and the billions of dollars behind him, it has become something real in the 16 months that I've been out there campaigning. And one of the driving motivators to the growth of that has been this corporate takeover. So I actively go and visit with all groups, including the Tea Party groups, because they and I see eye to eye with respect to the need to take our government back. I'm a strong supporter of publicly financed campaigns. I believe it's called the FAIR Act that Senator Durbin has had there for a long time. We need something like that. I talk about both publicly financed campaigns and term limits as a means to preserve democracy in this country. The environmental things, it's frustrating. Mr. Johnson voted the right way, according to environmental groups, 43% of the time. And I've spoken over the last year plus about the fact that this is the issue of most importance to me. Healthcare is what drove me out of my house to try to get to Washington, D.C. But as the years go by and I see the lack of movement in Washington and the way that they turn the most serious situation into a political football, this global climate change, when you read the science behind it, it's very, very clear that this thing's real and it's serious, and the deadline on it is right now. It's something that can't be put off, and it's an issue that will make all other issues moot. You know, in 50 or 80 years, they're going to be looking back and saying, what were they talking about Iraq and healthcare for when the Habitat for Humanity was dying? When, you know, we need to take steps now to make sure that our grandchildren's children have enough clean water to drink and enough clean air to breathe. And to be right 43% of the time, that's shameful. But if that's what he does to secure, to keep environmental groups from endorsing his opponent, myself, you know, I'm not impressed. We need someone that's right 100% of the time on the environment. Mm-hmm. And with respect to war, I don't buy it as authentic either. I have some lengthy discussions with members of the peace and justice community in the larger cities in our district. And this man sticks his finger in the wind. When the invasion of Iraq was popular, he was all for it. He was shaking his fist and saying, kill them there. When it became unpopular, and let it be known that I publicly opposed it before it happened. That's not Monday morning quarterbacking. I started to run for the 2004 campaign in December 2002. When the war became unpopular, he suddenly became a war opponent. And we need people in Washington who are leaders rather than followers. We need people that are well-read, that understand the history of places like Iraq, who have read Republican writings by like President George H.W. Bush, who spoke very fluently about what happens when you invade Baghdad.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest, Dr. David Gill. He's running for Congress in the 15th Congressional District. This would be his third run. He ran for the U.S. House in 2004 and 2006, each time against the Republican incumbent, Tim Johnson. I do want to say again that we offered to Representative Johnson the same opportunity to come be here on this program and to take calls and to talk, and he declined the invitation. So you have an opportunity here to ask whatever questions you have to our guest, Dr. Gill. He's a physician. He's an emergency room doctor. He makes his home in Bloomington, and he's here, and we will take the calls, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to quickly here ask a question, then we'll get back to calls. I wanted to have you talk a little bit about future gen. Now, I'm sure people are familiar with that, with this idea that it was the proposal to build a demonstration plant that would demonstrate that it was possible to burn coal, capture the carbon emissions, and then inject them into the ground to store them rather than have them go out into the atmosphere and contribute to greenhouse effect and global warming. And folks in Mattoon had put a lot of effort into trying to get it in Mattoon. And while it wasn't certain, I think there are a lot of folks in Mattoon thought it was pretty good chance that they were going to get this. And then, not very long ago, the government said, well, change of plans here. It's not going to be in Mattoon. They announced that the plant itself would be in a different place and that the storage could be yet in some other place to be determined. Mm-hmm. And so folks in Mattoon understandably were very disappointed. And some other communities now around Illinois are talking about, well, might we want to say, yeah, come here and have either of these two pieces of the plant. What do you think about this?
Well, I think it was very disappointing. I've listened to my opponent strut about and talk about future gen for years now. And, you know, it's really a complex history with respect to how Mattoon and Coles County got in line to have future gen land there. But when I started running this time, what I was telling people was Mattoon or future gen had arisen from the dead once again in, what, February or March of 2009 when the stimulus bill got passed. My opponent voted against that. Had his vote carried the day, future gen would have been dead then again. It would have stayed dead in the spring of 2009. It came back to life in spite of Mr. Johnson's vote and looked like it was going to work just the way you're talking about, have the coal burn there and have the sequestration underground there and until things, the wheels fell off about, what, 2.5, 3 months ago now. Yeah. And you know, and you hear, I'm not privy to the discussions that went on, but I do know that had I been sitting there in Washington, D.C. for a project that important, and I like the concept of future gen, I like anything that's creative with respect to preserving the habitability of this planet. I welcome all ideas with regards to that. And had I been there in Washington, D.C., I would have had very close interactions with the Department of Energy. I read all the time about Mr. Johnson spending 5 or 6 hours on the day cold calling constituents, and it's helped him win elections for 39 years now. But I don't know that I consider that good governing, so to speak. I think that having open and direct lines of communication with the Department of Energy toward making future gen come to be in the 15th district would have been a goal of mine. So it's and yet, I'm not privy to just how it fell apart there at the very end there a couple months ago.
Other calls. Next, Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
The median wage has been going down since 1973. What can we do about this ever-growing gap between the rich and the poor, where the rich get richer and more people get poor? And in our district, it seems they're getting poor faster than anywhere else.
They are. Poverty rates have risen 4 times faster than the national average during the first decade of this century here in Illinois 15. And I see it everywhere that I go. It's really becoming a beat-up district. It's become, you're right when you allude to the fact it's becoming a beat-up country. You know, those that work hard are getting the short end of the stick. And you're right. This has gone on for three decades plus. And I think that we need representatives in Washington who are there strictly because they care about their fellow man and woman, and all of their fellow men and women. I'm a strong supporter of organized labor. They have been clobbered over and over and over again since Ronald Reagan went to Washington, D.C., and I think that we have all, whether you're in a union or not, the things that they were able to accomplish were the things that helped lift us up as a people and create a broad middle class that was able to be reasonably comfortable while and have work available. Step after step after step that has been taken seems to have been taken to benefit the largest corporations. You look at NAFTA. I'm a believer that Ross Perot was right back in 1992 when he was running for president, and he talked about the sound you hear after signing NAFTA will be the giant sucking sound of jobs being taken out of this country. I think he was exactly on the mark. And so I think we need to rethink our trade policies. I think we need to raise real wages for hardworking people. Nobody that works hard for 40 hours a week should be living in poverty. And there shouldn't be 600,000 children each night going to bed with hungry bellies in this country. And we need people in Washington, D.C. who agree with me on that, who think that those should be priorities rather than nation building in Afghanistan, rather than giving $2 trillion to the drug companies.
Are there things that government can do to encourage job creation?
Very much so. You know, I alluded to that with when you do health care, right? That's a gigantic stimulus each and every year. That's $600 to $800 billion each year that we would take back out of the black hole that we throw it into and allow it to grow the economy. Like I said, day one, studies show 2.5 to 3 million new jobs. Saving this planet would go a long way toward creating millions of jobs. Right now, 60% of the giant blades that get put up on the wind turbines in this country are built in China. They should be built here. They are being built in Clinton, where I used to live. It's a small example, but something that can be replicated thousands of times. An old abandoned rail car plant sat empty. A few tax credits were given, and now there's 80 guys working full-time building those blades for the wind turbines that go up in McLean and Livingston County. They're going to be coming here to Champaign and Danville, and those guys would otherwise be drawing unemployment. And I was talking to an engineer about 3 or 4 weeks ago. He said he's been looking at putting solar panels along the shoulders of millions of miles of roadway in this country, and you know, why not? There's a lot of work in doing something like that. So doing health care right, taking care of the planet properly, there's millions of jobs to be had there. I think, again, looking again at our trade policies, the NAFTA and the CAFTA and the other ones that are patterned after that would go a long way toward job creation as well.
Another caller here. I want to thank the last and go to next, Bloomington, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Before my question, I just want to commend Dr. Gill for your public service, just in exercising your citizenship in running for office and not giving up quickly. And if I heard you correctly earlier, staying in the election process until you do get elected. And I just wish more of us would follow your example and also get involved in that way. My question, I think, is, at least in my opinion, underlies many of the issues that you've already addressed, and the in that I think the problems that we're facing at a core level are really rooted in our monetary system, in being an interest and debt-based monetary system. And I just wonder if you could speak to what extent you have studied and are aware of the history of our monetary system, the flaws and in it, the critiques of it, and alternatives to it. And one being, I know that there's at least in the writing stages and possibly to be introduced soon, a act called the American Monetary Act, which would address bring the Federal Reserve System out of the hand of public banks, where it's private banks, excuse me, where it's currently rooted. They're all private banks in the Federal Reserve System, and eliminate the fractional reserve system, which enables us to idiotically have this exponential growth curve in our economy just simply to pay the interest that money bears, and that would, instead of loaning money into circulation, would spend it into circulation. And it's a complicated issue, but I guess my basic question is, to what extent are you really studying and interested in and see sort of the core issue of our interest and debt-based money system that's a global system, but is efforts are happening at many, many grassroots levels in many countries around the world to create alternatives to a complementary currencies, as well as chipping away at the larger system to really eliminate this exponential growth and the extreme exponential growth of debt in our day.
All right, let's get some. You can, sure. It indeed a complicated question. You
right.
Do what you can.
I think it's an important question, and I appreciate it. I'm no expert on monetary policy. I've done a fair bit of reading, but I would defer to the caller and to others who know more than myself to offer me all the advice that they have to offer after I win this seat. I do know that the Federal Reserve, I listen to criticism of that setup from both the left and the right. I don't think that anybody's happy with the lack of transparency there. And I think that all elements in this system of democracy where man is ruling himself, everything should be above board and transparent, including monetary policy. I've read quite a bit about the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and I see them as being in league with some of the corporate global powers that really, you know, that drive things like NAFTA, that really don't have interest in the well-being of ordinary people. And I think that we need to take steps, again, to distance ourselves from those types of organizations.
Let me ask you, I want to get an email here. Someone said that they were glad to hear you talk about the Prescription Drug Act, that in the words of the listener here, waived the taxpayers' power of bargaining with pharmaceutical companies. I wants to know, can you say whether the Obama Health Care Reform Act managed to reverse the Prescription Drug Act? And if not, is anybody seriously talking about doing that? And also further asks, is it possible to estimate how much money would be saved by changing that?
And that's another upside to it, although it's a slow, drawn-out thing. They'll be working to remove the donut hole over, 8 to 10 years. And I don't know about the bargaining, to be frank with you. Obviously, it's a massive bill, which, speaks against the goodness of it. I'm not sure whether they left the bargaining or lack of ability to bargain in place there. And like I said, it's at a most economists, healthcare economists estimated it as a $2 trillion cost to the taxpayers, the inability to bargain. It's a shame. It boggles my mind that anybody, Republican or Democrat, including my opponent, voted yes on that one.
All right. We have about 6-7 minutes left. Our guest is David Gill. He's a Democratic candidate for Congress in the 15th Congressional District. We have some other calls. We'll try to get him in. Next is someone on a cell phone, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. If you're successful in limiting terms for Congress, I hope you'll also look at limiting their pensions, because I would hate to see somebody be able to serve 2 years in Congress and have a big pension and all of the other benefits that go with that for the rest of their lives. I just wanted to interject that, and I'll hang up.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. I appreciate that, and I agree with you 100%. You know, there's almost a sense of royalty in Washington, D.C., rather than it being a service before self type of ethos there. And, yeah, I don't think there should be any pension. Obviously, I can't undo what's done. But I think that whenever we get around as a country to saying, let's put term limits upon the other members of upon the legislative branch the way we do the executive branch, if we say they can only be there 6 years or 10 years, I don't think there ought to be a pension associated with it. I think it should be very, very service-oriented.
Line number 1 is next. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm a Democrat and a supporter of yours, but I'm concerned if we went to Medicare for everyone, that there would end up having to be rationing of care, as you hear about in Canada. Can you address that?
Sure. There's rationing today in this country. There's people that never do get their hip replaced because they need a new hip and they're 48 years old and they don't have insurance and they live another 15 years and ultimately die having had 15 years of agony. The Canadians are very, very pleased with their healthcare system. I'm a 20-year member of Physicians for a National Health Program. They have a great website, pnhp.org. And you hear anecdotally about this Canadian or that Canadian, but when you look at the broad mass, which I think in Washington we should be focused on the health care of 300 million Americans, Canadians, 88 to 90% in polls love their health care system. The greatest Canadian of all time, as voted upon a few years ago, was Tommy. His last name escapes me. It was actually Donald Sutherland's father, who was one of the prime ministers of one of the western provinces, who brought universal health care to that country back in the 50s. They voted him the greatest Canadian of all time. And so there are a lot of myths out there with respect to waiting times and inability to get what you need in Canada. When you look at whose health care is better, ranked on several different profiles and measurements, the Canadians measure up far, far better than we do at a fraction of the cost. And so rationing occurs. Rationing will always occur to some extent. Everybody can't have everything. And as a society, when we have a system, we can together make decisions. Should an actively drinking alcoholic be in the line to get a new liver when he's cirrhotic? And that's something that we need to decide as a culture, as a society. Or should he be rationed out in terms of getting a new liver?
Tom Rogers, our news director, came into this studio and said, Tommy Douglas.
That's his name.
He is
the greatest Canadian of all time as voted by Canadians.
Tommy Douglas. All right. We're, again, getting very short on time. We'll try to get at least one more caller. Line two, someone here in Champaign-Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was curious, if you are successful in your in being elected in your term in office, mm-hmm. I was curious how you tackle the issue surrounding illegal immigration. And I'll hang up the phone.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks. It's an important question. And, frankly, I think that this was something that President Bush in 2006 had right. He talked about a multi-pronged approach, the need to penalize and sanction the employers who were using the illegal immigrants, and the need to secure our borders. I agree with those things. I think that we ought to have an avenue whereby those who are here illegally now can get in the back of the line, get behind those who have done it legally. It's unrealistic and impractical to talk about actually loading 11 or 12 million people onto buses and sending them back home. I think there should be a pathway to citizenship for them, but they should pay whatever fines and back taxes they owe, and they should get in the back of the line, perhaps be encouraged to learn English, and our borders should be secured. I think President Bush had this just right, and unfortunately he was at a point in his second term that he couldn't seem to get anybody interested in moving forward with that.
Try real quick one more. Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello. Your opponent is always preaching about reducing taxes. We all know taxes are not going to go down. Please tell us you're not going to lie to us about that, too.
I would say I'm not going to tell you taxes are going to go down. I do think that you are taxed enough. I think it's a question of how we use our money. Are we going to continue with these endless trillion-dollar wars that don't seem to be making any of us more secure? Are we going to continue giving money away to drug companies? Are we going to continue with tax cuts to the wealthiest in our society? I don't think we should do those things that my opponent has supported. I think you're taxed plenty. You're right. I think no promises about lowering taxes. I'm very much in touch with people. I live amongst real people. I take care of real people. And that's one of the problems with the guys in Washington, that they do seem to be out of touch. I was very disappointed with my opponent's vote. A few months ago, they voted on whether or not to congratulate the New Orleans Saints on winning the Super Bowl. And that vote went 375-1. My opponent was the only guy who voted no on congratulating the Super Bowl winner in the whole country. And I started getting angry phone calls from around the country asking, what kind of people are we? And I'll never embarrass you in that way, because I understand what it is to be an ordinary person. I started working when I was 13 years old, bussing tables and washing dishes. And, you know, I won't talk down to you, and I'll always stand up for you.
About a minute. Anything that we have not touched on you'd like to mention?
Oh, I'm a big supporter of medical malpractice reform. I think that the current system as is has little to do with justice. And again, I was disappointed in my opponent. When the Democrats passed health care reform, there was an alternative bill that night, a Republican health care reform bill. Every Republican in the U.S. House voted for it except one, my opponent. He didn't like the idea of malpractice reform, which I think many people understand. Last comment, congressmen are like diapers. They need to be changed frequently and for the same reason.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is David Gill. He's a physician. He's an emergency room doctor, lives in Bloomington. That's where he makes his living. He is running for Congress in Illinois' 15th congressional district against the incumbent Republican Tim Johnson. I'm sure that if you'd like to find more about Dr. Gill, he does indeed have a website.
Yes.
So that's one place that you can go to get some more information on other things that we've not had the chance to talk about.
Gill2010.com. And thank you so much for allowing me to be here, David. It's
thank
a pleasure.
You.